hard to be humble when you're perfect in every way. I can't wait to look in the mirror, 'cause I get better looking each day. To know me is to love me, I must be a hell of a man. Oh Lord, it's hard to be humble, but I'm doing the best that I can. I used to have a girlfriend, but I guess she just couldn't compete with all those love-starved women who keep clamoring at my feet. I probably could find me another, I guess they're in all of me. Who cares, I've never been lonesome, 'cause I treasure my own company. Oh Lord, it's hard to be humble when you're perfect in every way. I can't wait to look in the mirror, 'cause I get better looking each day. To know me is to love me, I must be a hell of a man. Oh Lord, it's hard to be humble when we're doing the best that we can. I guess you could say I'm a loner, a cowboy who's lost nothing bright. I could have lots of friends if I want them, but then I wouldn't stand out from the crowd. Some folks say that I'm egotistical. Hell, I don't even know what that means. I guess it has something to do with the way that I fill out my skin-tight blue jeans. Oh, Lord, it's hard to be humble when you're perfect in every way. I can't wait to look in the mirror, 'cause I get better looking each day. To know me is to love me, I must be a hell of a man. Oh Lord, it's hard to be humble when we're doing the best that we can. Oh Lord, it's hard to be humble when you're perfect in every way. I can't wait to look in the mirror, 'cause I get better looking each day.
Well, there you go. That was Tommy Dell. I don't think many people have ever heard of him, but he's a good singer. But Mac Davis sang this song way back, too. Interesting fact of life that my lady lived in Lubbock when she was a kid, and she went to high school with Mac Davis there in Lubbock, Texas. Well, the reason I played that for you today, because I'm dedicating that to three people that you know and I know. Ronald Trump, Donald Trump, David Duke, and the bitch Hillary. Those three, I want that song to go out to, because it sure fits. Now, my gal says sometimes it fits me, too, but I don't believe that. I'm humble as humble pie. I was going down the highway yesterday, and was getting close to my turnoff, and there was a big black old Buick on my ass, going as fast as he could. And just before I got to my turnoff, he passed me doing about 75 miles an hour, giving me the finger. Yeah, sticking his arm out. And so he went to the corner, turned down my road, and all the way down that road, he had his arm out, giving me the finger, yelling and screaming. I couldn't hear what the hell he was screaming about. People like that are funny. Y'all, you notice when they give you the finger, but they're always running the other, going away fast as they can. I wanted him to pull off the side of the road and tell me what that meant, but he wouldn't do it. Well, it's hell when you got fans all over the place, you know. Yeah. Hey, it's 19th of May 2016. And I think either we got a full moon or no moon. I always get that clock, the giant atomic clock from Frank Silva, POW, and he's not a POW anymore. He'd been out a long time, but he was with the order. He gave me that clock, the Frank Silva Memorial Clock. Well, it's Thursday, and we're right here ready to go. And we swept out the cells this morning. Those damn people, we got in there like Jerry the Jew. They're dirty as hell, and we got to clean out those cells once in a while. That's a dirty job. Well, we got two more wars to cover this week out of our book that was printed in 1927, The War Myth in the United States History by C.H. Hamblin, who explains why most of these wars didn't have to happen. They could have been sidestepped. But this is the big the big one today, the Civil War. The Civil War was a result of a series of political crimes and blunders of which both sections of the country were equally guilty. Get that? Whites on both sides were guilty. It was not inevitable or necessary to fight in order to abolish slavery. No, they shouldn't have brought them over here in the first place. And when they started being too much trouble, they needed to ship them back to Africa right away. But the southern oligarchs, the plantation owners, this was property, and they surely didn't want to give up their property. And, of course, they weren't averse to getting into a civil war because they were fearful of the white working class, the poor class in the South, too. They always were not only concerned about slave uprisings, but they were concerned about white poor uprisings in the South. They don't talk about that much. I've got books on that, but you don't hear people talking about it. In every country of the world, slavery had been abolished without war. The question of slavery had never been a party issue until after the Mexican War, but from then until the election of 1860, slavery was the leading political issue. During the war with Mexico, Wilmot of Pennsylvania offered what is known as the Wilmot Proviso, which provided that the territory acquired from Mexico should be closed to slavery. Although this bill was defeated in Congress, it brought up the question of the further extension of slavery. See, these guys, these slavers, they wanted to move slavery all the way out, of course, into the Southwest, which they did. But they wanted to move it all the way up into the Northwest, Oregon, Washington, all up through there. Because it was such a profitable deal, you know, getting labor without paying any money. That's the dream of the capitalist oligarchs. We want to make a lot of money. We don't want to pay anybody any wages. Or if we do, they're going to be low wages. That's why today they rail against so-called socialism. Well, socialism came out as a firewall to capitalism and communism. Socialism was the in-between, and there had to be something. And for people to say that socialism doesn't work, well, we've got a hell of a lot of socialism in the United States. I mean, the United States military is one of the most socialist entities in the country. And, of course, it's one of the biggest pushers of race mixing in the country, too. Yeah, so that's one point. At the time of the Mexican War, there were two national parties, the Whigs and the Democrats. These two parties embraced almost all of the people. And as both were strong in both sections of the United States, they tended to cement the union. For parties on a national basis tend to unify a nation, while sectional parties lead to disunion. Well, that's what we should have went that way, sectional parties. We need to keep the country broken up in small, as far as, I mean, smaller units. Coming together in these large political parties was a mistake, and even some of the so-called founding real estate guys knew that too. They didn't want to have big parties. But how can you make a lot of money if you don't have big parties? The anti-slavery people and the moderates gravitated towards the Whig Party, while the pro-slavery people gravitated towards the Democratic proper party. Now, you know, the Democrat Party was responsible for more of the wars up until the Second World War, no, and even after the Second World War. And then the Republicans took over as the war party. The Whigs elected General Zachary Taylor president in 1848, although he was a large slaveholder in Louisiana. He was a moderate and was satisfactory to all the groups and sections. He had the support of Lincoln as well as of the Southern Whigs. Soon after Taylor became president, Henry Clay, who was another big promoter of slavery, proposed the famous Compromise of 1850, the more important feature of which admitted California as a free state, organized the remainder of the territory taken from Mexico without regard to slavery, abolished the slave trade in the District of Columbia, and passed a fugitive slave law to be enforced by the federal government. See, this is not, none of this is to promote the white race. This is all money. This is all about money and property. This compromise, although a Whig major, was instrumental in killing the Whig Party. No party or section was satisfied with it. President Taylor opposed it, but his death before its passage brought to the presidency the Vice President Fillmore, who allowed it to become law without his signature. The provision that broke up the Whig Party was the strict fugitive slave law, and anti-slavery Whigs repudiated their party. The idea of fugitive slaves was shocking to the best moral judgment of the time. The leaders of moral sentiments, ministers, ooh, there you go, Christ insanity, poets and reformers of every type advised disobedience. It was a dead letter because the moral sentiment of the age was against it. On the, they're against slavery, but they don't have an answer to freed slaves. They just, oh, we'll free them, and there they go, wandering through your country, millions of them, which happened after the Civil War. The pro-slavery people did not like it because it was not enforced. Thus, the law was treated with contempt by both parties. The Whig Party, which was moderate, national, opposed to expansion, and the extension of slavery was disrupted. It sounds like they, in my sense of the thing, they did all right. That was, Whig Party was doing all right. But they were going up against the big money people, really. The Democrats carried all except four states in 1852 and remained in power until 1860. Dominated by powerful pro-slavery sentiment throughout this period. Not pro-white sentiment. No. This pro-slave, owning a slave mentality. Follow the money. After the fall of the Whig Party, the Republican Party was organized in 1856. It took the name Republican from the followers of Thomas Jefferson, and claimed it was a revival of the party of Jefferson, who was a big, big slave owner. And Jefferson never freed any of his slaves except one on his deathbed. It was the Liberal Party opposed to slavery. It was organized and until after the Civil War dominated by liberal element in the United States. The Democratic Party, I don't like that, it's not the Democratic Party, it's the Democrat Party, also claimed themselves to be followers of Jefferson, which they were not. Sounds nowadays they do that with Reagan. Everything they want to say, Reagan was wonderful, Reagan was great, and Reagan agrees with me and all that kind of bullshit. Trying to make him a good conservative. He never was a good conservative. Check the figures, check the records, read the history of Ronald Reagan's activity. And he had to run it through his astrologer, too. Everything that Reagan did in the White House went through an astrologer who lived in the White House. The Democratic Party also claimed themselves to be followers of Jefferson, which they were not at that time, except in a very narrow legal sense. Jefferson was opposed to slavery and special privilege in every form. Wait a minute. Jefferson was opposed to slavery? He owned hundreds of slaves. Are you kidding? You know, that's like a guy who is opposed to alcoholism, but he owns a bar. In 1800, he advocated states' rights or a decentralized government because he believed the states were and would always be more popular controlled than the federal government. Well, I agree with that. But by 1860, that situation was reversed. After the fall of the Whig Party, the Republican Party was organized in 1856. Oh, I covered that. The Republican Party organized until after Civil War, dominated by the liberal element in the United States. The Democratic Party also claimed themselves to be followers of Jefferson, which they were not at the time, except in a very narrow legal sense. Jefferson was opposed to slavery and special privileges in every form. I've read this. What the hell? But by 1860, that situation was reversed. The states, especially the southern states, had begun to dominate by the privileged group, the plantation owners, who talked in terms of states' rights to perpetuate this privilege, while Jefferson talked in terms of states' rights because he feared the domination of the federal government by the reactionary element. You see, they wanted states' rights to protect their business of slavery. That's what they wanted states' rights for. Both Lincoln and Jefferson held the same views socially. The Democratic Party of the pre-Civil War period had repudiated Jefferson. But the Republican Party did not become reactionary until after the Civil War. When the Republican Party was organized in 1856, it was regarded as a red, chiefly in the eyes of the South, for it was organized principally with the idea of keeping slavery out of the West. In other words, there was one thing good for the white race. If they hadn't have done that, the whole West and Northwest would have been niggerized long, long time ago. Its campaign literature in 1856 was composed largely of anti-slavery utterances of Jefferson. To the South, Republican, anarchy, abolitionists, Lincoln, John Brown, and Garrison were soon to become synonymous terms. Because of this, the Republican Party had no following in the South, even among the great many people who wished to abolish slavery. It became a sectional party, which was its fatal weakness in dealing with slavery, as compared to the former Whig Party, which had a national following. The Republican Party was sectional before 1860. Lincoln had been a Whig and had accepted the Compromise of 1850. Although he was one of the great men of all times, I don't believe that. He was a goddamn dictator. He was a victim of many of the common errors of his age. No, he was a politician. That's the common error. Reflecting the belief of his time, he considered slavery a stable institution until it became easier for him to go the other way, just like Hillary and all the rest. His great democratic spirit lay in the fact that he expressed the ideas of the common man and had complete faith in him until he disagreed with him. Then he took his right to speak away from him. Got rid of habeas corpus. That don't show that he was much of a friend of the common man. He tried to recognize and give expression to the purposes and aspirations of the masses. I think this part's bullshit, which made him one of the world's greatest Democrats, with democracy's strengths and weaknesses. He was a goddamn dictator. That's it. Lincoln was not a creative thinker and had few pretensions in that direction. You can say that again. He had no intention of abolishing slavery in the states. He simply wished to prevent it from spreading. He also held the common attitude of his age that the Negro belonged to an inferior race. Well, he had that right. In the election of 1860, Lincoln polled only 26,430 votes in the entire South, and those were from the upper section. The upper section was made up of small yeomanry with small little plots of land and maybe a little raise a little cotton, but they didn't have slaves. Almost none of those people from the upper section were slavers. That's why they didn't have really much reason to get involved in the Civil War. However, they were drafted. Yeah, they drafted in the North, and then they did it also in the South later on. Douglas, the moderate Democrat, received 163,525 votes in the South. Bell of the Unionist Party received 515,973 votes in the same section, while Breckinridge, the extreme pro-slavery candidate, received 570,871 votes in the entire South. So you see, they're voting with their pocketbook. They be voting with their pocketbook. Man, we gonna want to hang on to this free labor. We got to have free labor. We don't want to bring more white people in here and split this stuff up and make small farms. No, we want big plantations and lots of niggers. Breckinridge carried the lower South by a plurality, while Lincoln carried the West and the North by a plurality and was elected president. The Douglas and Bell voters of the South were opposed to secession, but all the secession vote went to Breckinridge, although not all Breckinridge vote was for secession. A majority in the South opposed secession, but the Southern states fell into the hands of the secessionists by a plurality. Why did the South secede? Lincoln was elected on a platform of defying Dred Scott decision in 1857. According to this decision, the Constitution recognized slavery, and therefore Congress could not prohibit it in the Western territories. This could be done only by the states through their constitutions or by the federal government through a constitutional amendment. This was a great legal victory for slavery, but Lincoln defied the decision and expected the next move on the part of the pro-slave advocates to be an attempt to legalize slavery in the northern states through a Supreme Court decision. So the slave owners were not only in charge in the South, they were pushing to actually bring slavery into the North. Lincoln, when asked what he meant by saying the Union could not exist half free and half slave, said that slavery would eventually have to go, but it would probably last 100 years. It didn't take the other countries around the world that long to get rid of slavery. He did not realize that slavery was dying. Well, it was also dying because of the invention of the cotton gin and mechanization. This election of Lincoln on a platform defying a decision of the U.S. Supreme Court caused the lower South to secede as a gesture to uphold the courts and the Constitution. Lincoln coerced them in order to uphold the Constitution, for he had been legally elected president and his office required his execution of federal laws. Thus, both the North and the South fought to defend the Constitution. so much for the Constitution. Both felt themselves defensive. Neither section understood the other, and the emotionalism in the matter was so kindled that the reason could not function on either side. The Civil War was a war about an abstraction, the status of slavery in the Western Territory, which was the real cause of the war. They didn't want to spread slavery into the West. And, of course, I agree. There were other differences between the North and the South, but none of them would have resulted in a war had not the slave question entered into the conflict. See, the blacks have been giving us trouble forever. And the reason they've been giving us trouble forever is because the ruling class, the white traders, the white economic elite, the white capitalists, use the blacks and so forth to make their money and get what they want. The blacks are only in the middle, and that's the problem we've got. If you're going to solve the black problem, first you've got to clean out the white problem. The no-good whites that have quite a bit of white power yet, but it's not anything that helps us. By 1860, slavery in the greater part of civilized world was dead or dying institution. Great Britain in 1833 abolished slavery in all her possessions. Of course, even though she promoted it big time for a long, long time. And don't forget, it wasn't just cotton either, it was sugar. And sugar was a horrible danger for people to be eating. And it's still a danger. As much a danger as the black race, sugar. Mexico provided for the gradual abolition of slavery as early as 1827. Even the mestizos got rid of slavery. Brazil followed in 1888, and Spain abolished slavery in Cuba in 1878. In all these cases, it had been done without conflict. No war, not a bunch of people getting killed. All the northern states of the Union had become free, and the western states and territories were repudiating slavery as well. When California drew up her constitution and asked for admission in 1850, the clause prohibiting slavery was adopted by a unanimous vote of her constitutional convention. In the referendum held in Kansas in 1858, 11,300 out of the total vote of 13,088 were opposed to slavery. They were opposed to blacks, most of them. They could see what was happening as the black race spread. Only a few slaves had been carried there, and they could never have been permanently held as slaves. New Mexico was organized as a territory in 1850 without regard to slavery, and at one time as many as 22 slaves had been carried there. Nevada, Colorado, and Dakota were organized as territories before 1860, but had no slaves. In Missouri, slavery was on the decrease. If judged by its percentages, the entire population in 1830, 17.8% of the Missouri population were slaves, Negroes. In 1840, 15.5%, in 1850, 12.8%, 1860, only 9.8%. I don't know where those Negroes were going, but they were leaving Missouri. Slavery would have existed in Missouri only for a few more years, for the anti-slavery population was increasing rapidly by settlers from the free states and great numbers of people from Germany who settled in the neighborhood of St. Louis and were especially opposed to slavery. Before 1860, slavery was non-existent in all the sections of the Union except tobacco, cotton, and sugarcane belts. In upholding the institution of slavery, the South was opposed to the spirit of the age. Well, slavery had become was not as profitable. That's why, as technology started being created around the world, slavery didn't work as well. So they couldn't make as much money off slaves. Slavery was beginning to become more of a problem than it was worth. Slavery was doomed by moral and economic pressure. But Tommy says more by economic pressure than moral. It was a useless procedure for the South to demand the right to carry slavery into the Western Territory because it was unprofitable, for economically it was not wanted. Or the same, well, even in the South, actually, slavery is a very poor economic way to make money. In the long run, you're better off splitting up the land in small parcels and small farms for white families. For the same reason, it was futile for the opponents of slavery to try to prohibit by law its extension westward. The Westerners had no desire or use for it. It was this contention over slavery in the Western Territory which was the abstraction over which the Civil War was fought. Many people before 1860 saw the folly of this controversy. Governor Robert J. Walker of Mississippi recognized that the West would never be open to slavery, as did Stanton of Tennessee and Senator Toombs of Georgia. The status of slavery in the West had become automatically settled by the laws of nature. The two sections, however, had cherished perverted ideas of each other. It was reported and actually believed in the North that Senator Robert Toombs of Georgia had boastfully declared that he would call the roll of his slaves in Massachusetts. The following incidents, given in Macy's Political Parties in the United States, page 209 to 211, are illustrative of the state of public excitement preceding the Civil War. In an effort to dictate the slave policy of the West, Charlie B. Lyons, a deacon of a New Haven congregation, had enlisted a company of 79 immigrants for war. A meeting was held in the church shortly before their departure for the purpose of raising funds, at which many clergymen and members of the Yale College faculty were present. The leaders of the party announced that Sharp's rifles were lacking and that they were needed for self-defense. After an earnest address from Henry Ward Beecher, that's the husband of Harriet Beecher Snow, the one who wrote the Uncle Tom's Cabin. Professor Silliman started the subscription with one Sharp's rifle. The pastor of the church gave the second. 50 was the number wanted. Then Beecher announced that if 25 were pledged on the spot, Plymouth Church would furnish the rest. See, now here's Christ's insanity getting involved in politics, like they always have been. The churches in both sections had by then become agencies for propagating hatred. Another incident is a southern one. Colonel Buford of Alabama sold a number of his slaves valued at $20,000 and invested the money to equip a troop of 300 soldiers to fight for southern rights in Kansas. The day that Buford's battalion started from Montgomery, they marched to the Baptist church. The Methodist minister solemnly invoked a divine blessing on the enterprise. The Baptist pastor gave Buford a finely bound Bible and said that a subscription had been raised to present each immigrant with a copy of the Holy Scripture. This battalion left for the West armed with Bibles and sharp rifles. The existence of such a condition of excitement made it an easy matter to participate war. In political contests, the natural tendency is for persons of extreme views to gain leadership. You get that? Yeah, that's what happens. Decided and partisan convictions are easily described and understood, whereas people of moderate and discreet judgment often lack conviction themselves and so cannot very well impress their views upon the masses. Garrison's extreme abuse of the South was met there with similar other extremes. The abolitionists had great sympathy for the oppressed, but great hatred for the oppressor, and regarded the slave owner as personally responsible for slavery rather than as an agent of circumstances. Perhaps if the abolitionists had directed their appeal to the moral conscience of the South, avoiding sectional and personal abuse, secession would never have taken place. The South met this abuse by demanding that all anti-slavery publications be excluded from the mails. Books, papers, and all publications suspected of containing anti-slavery propaganda were taken from the mails and publicly burned at Charleston, South Carolina. There were many manifestations of disregard for the sanctity of the mails. The North judged the South by these extreme actions, and the efforts of the South to suppress anti-slavery agitation resulted only in greater propaganda for the abolitionists. The public is quick to demand war, but it's not so willing to accept its hardship. Boy, there's the very true sentence right there. White people are quick to demand war, but is not so willing to accept its hardships. During the conflict, it was necessary for both North and South to suspend civil liberties, including freedom of the press and speech. See, there you go. Expressions that might weaken war morale were punished. Both sections suspended the writ of habeas corpus and arbitrarily imprisoned their citizens who couldn't get a break into courts. About 38,000 people were imprisoned in the North, while the number in the South is unknown. Both sections, as in all major wars, resorted to the draft to recruit soldiers. Yet with all these weapons at their disposal, the Northern Army succeeded in enlisting only about 1,325,000 of its native white population out of a total of 23 million. Just like the Revolutionary War, there weren't only a small percentage were technically involved. Besides approximately 1,325,000 native whites, the Northern Army consisted of 300,000 whites from the South, 186,000 Negroes, and 500,000 foreigners, mostly white. Left to the voluntary support of its citizens, neither section could have carried on the war, as no major war of modern times could have been fought with that volunteer support alone. The draft acts of both sections allowed for the employment of substitutes, which, of course, was hard on the poorer classes of whites who could not employ substitutes, but the richer classes often avoided army service by this method, and they still do. It is impossible to obtain an exact figure for the number of substitutes employed, but the Secretary of War under Davis considered 50,000 a low estimate for the Confederate Army in 1864. Desertion was frequent on both sides. Rhodes estimates the number of deserters in the South at 100,000 in 1864, and they had agents that went through the countryside tracking them down, just like these white people were slaves, because they didn't want to serve in the war. So instead of chasing Negroes, they were chasing white people. Much has been heard of the heroism and sacrifice displayed during the conflict, but little of the crimes committed by both sections. Only the pleasant faces of the war had survived. When Joseph Holt and Robert Dale Owens were appointed by Secretary of War Stanton to adjust claims for materials supplied to the War Department, they found fraud at every turn. And before making their final report in July 1862, secured deductions of nearly $17 million from claims amounting to $50 million. One claim alone was reduced $1 million, and another was reduced $580,000. One senator had received $10,000 for securing an order from the War Department for a client. Colonel Henry S. Alcott, who was appointed special commissioner to investigate frauds after a thorough examination of the facts, announced that from 20% to 25% of the expenditures of the federal treasury during the Civil War was tainted with fraud, and according to his estimate, approximately $700 million was paid through fraud. In commenting upon moral conditions during the conflict, the Springfield Republican said editorially, "It is sad a shocking picture of life in Washington, which our correspondents are giving us. A bureau of the Treasury Department made a home of seduction and prostitution. The necessities of the poor and the pretty women made the means of their debauchery by the high government officials, members of Congress, putting their mistresses into clerkships, into the departments, and whiskey drinking ad libitum. These are some of the typical incidents of conditions in both sections, but textbooks in treating of this war, as of all others, present only those phases of which glorify the war. The cost of the Civil War, including the expenditures on both sections, pensions, destruction of property, and other indirect expenses, was $12 million. Its damages to the morale and spiritual development of the United States cannot be estimated. And that's the end of our situation there on the Civil War. Again, the white race loses big time. Just operating the Civil War for a couple of weeks cost more than it would have cost to ship all the Negroes of all the plantations back to Africa. Yeah, that seems odd, doesn't it? But it's true. Just for a couple of weeks of the war, or maybe a month or so, of the amount of money it cost to run the war, they could have shipped all the blacks back to Africa and didn't need to have a war. And as Smedley Butler, General Smedley Butler, the hero of Central America and so forth, in the army, said, war is a racket, and war is always a racket. And if you involve yourself in war, you're a racketeer. You're a racketeer, too, especially if you profit from it. As far as I'm concerned, if you promote war and occupation, you're an enemy of the white race. That's it. Case closed. Next, we'll cover the war with Spain and Cuba and all that stuff. In fact, I just was reading today about how much money we've spent sending all kinds of military armaments to Egypt. Billions of dollars in weaponry to Egypt. You see, this stuff just gets authorized through this War Department or whatever, or the Defense Department, it goes. And there's nobody putting the brakes on it. So that means that every congressman and every senator, unless otherwise identified as a goddamn criminal, war criminal, and should be tried and, I say hung, but if you want to put them in prison for the rest of their life, okay. I also was amused today when I heard some of these conservatives were saying that by closing Guantanamo and bringing a few prisoners that are down there into the prison in the United States, that's a problem with national defense. That's the biggest bunch of bullshit I ever heard. Number one, they should be just sent back to their countries, close down that Guantanamo Bay, and give it back to Cuba. That's Cuba's land anyhow. But to call a few prisoners that are down there to be brought to the United States where they could get lawyers and have some defense, that's the deal. The Republicans and Warhawks don't want these guys to have lawyers that might get them out and get them free and get them home. They call that's a problem with national defense. So bringing a few prisoners into the United States and putting them in a prison is going to bring the country down. What a bunch of horse shit. Here's another funny one. Business has boomed in Donald Trump's financial empire during the time he's been running for president, according to an analysis of his federal disclosure forms. The documents, including a lengthy filing released Wednesday and one from last July, show that the revenue increased by what Trump campaign statements say is almost $190 million, with gains coming from golf courses to be branded merchandise to book royalties. At his Tony Florida resort, Mar-a-Lago, revenue nearly doubled, climbing from about $16 million in 2014 in the first half of 2015 to about 30 million since the start of his campaign, according to Forbes. I think it's funnier than hell. That's funny. Sales of his licensed bottled water brand, Trump Ice, are up as well, from 280,000 last year to 413,000 this year. Crippled America, his book published in November, made between 1 million and 5 million in royalties, he reported. A flood of cash receipts, one of the most unusual aspects of Trump's candidacy, the potential that a private businessman could benefit financially from a run for the White House, and it shows how his fortunes have evolved since last year when his controversial comments about immigration and the Muslims threatened to tarnish his business brand even if they boosted his political campaign. But it's been just the opposite. Trump announced a new filing Tuesday saying he is proud that it is the largest in the history of the FEC. Government officials declined to confirm Trump's assertion. Presidential candidates are required to provide under oath an annual Financial Disclosure Act of their business interests. To gauge the effect of the campaign on Trump's companies, the Washington Post compared his two disclosure forms, which were released by the Federal Elections Commission. Last year's form reported that Trump's holdings brought in revenue of $362 million. In 2014, the first half of 2015, the campaign said in a statement. The form released Wednesday, which the campaign said shows revenue spiking at $557 million, covers a shorter period of time but encompasses the life of his presidential campaign from July 2015 until Monday. I think that's funnier than hell. Always follow the money. You want to look for corruption? Always follow the money. But I think it's funny. Worse is better. Fuck it. The new disclosure comes amid swirling questions about Trump's income and net worth. This week he reiterated that his past claim that he was worth more than $10 billion, although he has not provided independent evidence to back up that claim. His refusal to release his tax returns, which would provide detailed information about his income, has drawn fire from some Republican critics and likely Democratic nominee Hillary Clinton. Well, I don't think she's released much of hers either. Clinton Corporation's worth hundreds of millions. That's where the profit is. Why do we want politicians and political parties and governments? Why do we want them? They're no good to us. They're no good to the white working class. Why don't we get rid of them? Why don't we just turn our back and not vote or do anything like that? Oh, I know. They make you afraid. They make people afraid. We got to have big armies and big guns and big bombs because they're going to get us. They're going to get us. Americans have become cowardly. Or maybe the public is always cowardly. They used to call Ronald Reagan a Teflon, like a Teflon Don. Nothing stuck to him. I think that Donald Trump has outdid Reagan by leaps and bounds. Trump listed board positions of 564 different entities, most of them small partnerships or one-owner companies tied to Trump's real estate. Trump said he also collected $168,584 as part of a pension from the Screen Actors Guild. He deserves more than that for the part he's playing now. We always thought Ronald Reagan was the best at that. This guy is far outdistance Ronald Reagan. The report showed that his marquee project to build a luxury hotel down the street from the White House, and that'd be a good whorehouse there, that close to the White House, has prompted Trump to tack on some additional debt, a loan of $170 million from the Deutsche Bank. So if he builds that hotel, he'll take the whole top floor when he's a president. He can fill it with whores. And which I've advocated that for decades, that they build these giant buildings like that around the White House and have them well-equipped bars and whores and drugs or whatever, and encourage the politicians and representatives to go over there, because the more they're out of the White House, the more money they save the people. Give them all the free drinks and everything, free whores they want. The disclosure also showed that Trump had, over the last year, opened new advisory, licensing, and management corporations for ventures in foreign cities such as Jeddah, Saudi Arabia, and Kolkata, India. How about that? Oh, boy. I don't know what to say, but that's it for right this moment. Well, now they've got 2016 kosher riverboat cruises. The only all-kosher luxury cruise vacation on the Danube, August 19th to August 26th. Special guest, Rabbi J.J. Schechter. Going down the Rhine. I don't know whether I want to be on one of those excursion boats if it's all Jews. You never know what might happen. I don't know. I don't think that's too wise, getting that many Jews in one spot at one time. But nobody ever listens to me. Everybody knows there's Nazis all along that Rhine River. They got those big castles and stuff, you know. We even heard rumors that ISIS has got a submarine down that damn Rhine River. So they better watch out. Well, that's it for today, boys and girls. I'll try to dig up some more crap for tomorrow. Yeah, we'll see you tomorrow on Freya's Day. That's Ladies' Day. She-Wolf Day in the bunker. Don't miss it.
God, I'm just tripping. This city is a trip. It's hard for a black man to get a cab here. I didn't know this is like New York and everywhere else. It's strange. What the fuck is going on? Cab is trying to run me over trying to pick up somebody white. That's some wild shit. It's true. You have to hire somebody white to get one for you. Some cold shit, ain't it? These motherfuckers can hardly speak English trying to have attitude. What are you going? Where are you going? I said, no. Where is your green card, motherfucker? Bitch, where are you going? To your mama's house, motherfucker. What are you going? And I just want to, I'm being honest, see, but see, it bothers me. So I don't know whether the white people can relate to it, because it doesn't happen to you, so I don't know if you can relate to it. But when the shit happens to you, then it's going to be a different motherfucking story. Because, see, that ozone is getting big out there. You guys don't have melanin in your skin, and pretty soon you ain't going to be able to go outside when the sun is out. You're going to need niggas again to call up niggas to do your shopping. It's going to be like the old days. Calling niggas, Leroy there, Leroy, Tyrone. Well, wake up Laquisha's ass. I'm hungry. And niggas, we're going to finally have the beach to ourselves. Won't that be fun? Have that fucking beach to ourselves. We can get out there and sunbathe, just show out. And then a good day will be, and the white people get to come out there and they'll scare the shit out of them. I thought they were seals. We'll scare the fuck out of them. We will scare the shit out of them. But white people always go where they don't belong. They could be driving down the freeway and they go, is it midnight? Let's go for a swim. They do some crazy shit, don't they? That's why I love that movie Jaws. I saw that movie 150 fucking times. They threw me out the theater. They said, no, nigga, now you're going to have to go. You've eaten up all the fucking popcorn. Come on, nigga. You're going to have to go. I love Jaws. Come on, Jaws. Come back. Get him. You missed some little white babies. Jaws. Because Jaws is eating some white babies. White people were terrified of Jaws. I said, damn, is this what they scared of? Sharks? I bought sharks. I got pet sharks in my backyard. Whatever scares white people, I put in my backyard. I got pet sharks, med flies, whatever scares them. Niggas that go to school, whatever scares them. And it's, you know what, though? I'm just up here bullshitting because it really ain't black and white. It really is not. Because you know why? White folks really love niggas. Don't let them fool you. Because you got to go back in the history because we used to, it's ownership. Because when white folks own niggas, we were in their house. You don't let nobody in your house you hate. We were in the guy, and the mammy, the babies are sucking on their titties, cooking their fucking food. Wasn't central heat. You know we was warming up the bed. Get your big black ass up in that bed. Warm it up. I'm going to sleep in 5 minutes. It's chilly in here. I'll get in there and warm it up. They loved us. Soon as we got free, that shit changed, didn't it? Niggas live on this block. I don't think I want to live here. Now we can't even be on the same block. Trust me, if slavery came in tomorrow, niggas be, white folks be all open arms. Oh, welcome home, niggas. Missed you. Sing one of those songs, please. Here, Hammer, catch that chicken. Ah, that's too cold, ain't it? I don't mean to be that mean. Yes, I do.